Chapter 7 Energy Poverty. How will we know when Africa as a continent stands a chance to climb sustainably out of poverty? My metric is very simple. It's when I see Angelina Jolie posing next to a vast field of solar panels in Ghana or a wind farm crowded with turbines in Zimbabwe. In recent years, Jolie and other celebrities have done a great service by drawing attention to Africa's travails. In highlighting the issues of poverty and disease, they have brought some much-needed global aid and debt relief. But there is one problem in Africa that almost never gets the spotlight, and that is Africa's shortage of light. If you look at satellite pictures of the Earth at night, it is quite stunning. Little lights flicker across Europe, the Americas, and Asia, while vast swaths of Africa are simply pitch black. AIDS relief has its champions, as do water purification, forest preservation, malaria treatment, and the alleviation of poverty. But the problem of energy poverty has no champion. It's not sexy. It has no international constituency, no buzz, no wristband, no human face. No one wants to embrace power plants, which are either dirty politically or just plain dirty. Worse, they take years to finance and build, and you can't see the results of your investment for a long time. Energy, in fact, is Africa's oldest orphan. But how, one wonders, will the tides of poverty, HIV, AIDS, unsafe drinking water, and malaria be turned back in Africa for good without enough energy to turn on the lights? According to the World Bank, the Netherlands today produces as much electrical power annually as all of sub-Saharan Africa, excluding South Africa. 20 gigawatts. Every 2 weeks or so, China adds as much power, 1 gigawatt of electricity, as the 47 countries of sub-Saharan Africa, excluding South Africa, add every year. But despite this staggering power gap, the problem of energy poverty rarely gets discussed. Universal access to electricity was not even one of the 8 Millennium Development Goals that were set out by the UN and the world's leading development institutions in 2000. Those goals range from cutting extreme poverty in half to providing universal primary education, all by 2015. How are we going to eradicate poverty without eradicating energy poverty? I first heard the term energy poverty from Robert Freeling, executive director of the Solar Electric Light Fund, SELF.org, which delivers solar power and wireless communications to rural and remote villages throughout the developing world. The right of every person to have access to energy is as fundamental as the right to access to air and water, Freeling argues. But it is often overlooked by very smart people who are dedicated to solving the problems of development. It is hard to believe in this day and age, but the World Bank estimates that roughly 1.6 billion people, one out of every 4 people on the planet, don't have regular access to an electricity grid. Every night is a blackout for 1.6 billion people. In sub-Saharan Africa, excluding South Africa, according to the World Bank, 75% of households, or 550 million people, have no access to network electricity. In South Asia, places like India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh, 700 million people, 50% of the overall population, and 90% of the rural population, are not on the grid. And under business-as-usual scenarios, the International Energy Agency projects that 1.4 billion people will still lack access to electricity in 2030. Meanwhile, indoor air pollution caused by the smoke emitted from cooking over open fires with inefficient stoves and pots, the most common alternative to grid electricity, is responsible for 1.6 million deaths per year, mostly of young children and mothers. That means that this biomass cooking as a cause of death ranks just behind malnutrition, unsafe sex, and lack of clean water and sanitation, according to the World Health Organization. Why is there still so much energy poverty in the world? It has different causes in different regions. In some places, surging economic growth and population explosions have combined to overwhelm supply. In others, high oil and natural gas prices have forced poor countries to ration. In still others, prolonged droughts have crippled hydroelectric power. But if there is one common denominator that cuts across all energy-poor countries, it's the simple fact that they don't have functioning utilities that are able to raise financing on the scale needed to build and properly operate power plants and transmission lines. And the reason is that these countries are plagued by either persistent misgovernance or persistent civil war, or both. The two are usually interrelated, particularly in Africa. If a country doesn't have a functioning government or a state of relative domestic peace that would enable it to enter into the long-term planning, designing, financing, building, and operating of expensive power plants and transmission grids, and they are all long-term projects, the lights will never come on or stay on for very long or for very many people. And even in places where the government works and the society is stable, power projects often run aground because that government doesn't allow the utility to operate as an independent commercial entity and charge the prices it requires to keep investing, or because it turns the utility into a honeypot of patronage or booty for political leaders. Much of the debt relief offered to Africa today is actually about forgiving loans made for power projects that were built but failed because of corruption or misrule. Lawrence Musaba, the manager of the South African Power Pool, a 12-nation consortium of electricity utilities at the continent's tip, told the New York Times, July 29, 2007, "We've had no significant capital injection into generation and transmission from either the private or public sectors for 15, maybe 20 years. My colleague Michael Wines, who wrote that story, also noted that in Nigeria, Africa's most populous nation, the government reported in April 2007 that only 19 of 79 power plants work. Daily electricity output has plunged 60% from its peak, and blackouts cost the economy $1 billion a year, the Council for Renewable Energy in Nigeria says. Energy is like any other economic good. It needs decent governance, functioning institutions, and effective markets to get electrons from the producer to the consumer on a sustained basis. Without reliable energy, virtually every aspect of life is negatively affected. After all, energy, at its most basic, is the capacity to do work." At the village level, Freeling explained, energy poverty means you can't pump clean water regularly, there's no communications, no way to have adult literacy classes, and certainly no way to run computers at school or have access to connectivity. This perpetuates social inequality. It is mostly the women in rural villages that bear the greatest burden of energy poverty, because it is they who must walk for miles every day to fetch water for drinking and bathing, or to collect firewood. Young girls are often taken out of primary school to assist in the daily struggle for energy subsistence. In addition, said Freeling, because women in African villages are generally responsible for cooking family meals, they are the ones most seriously affected by indoor air pollution, which is caused by kerosene lamps and open fires in poorly ventilated kitchens. Teenage girls in many African countries will not go to school when they are menstruating if the school has no clean water, which usually requires some form of electric power to produce. Energy use and gross national product are very closely correlated. Factories that don't have grid power have to rely on backup generators, which are usually much more expensive to run and more polluting. According to the World Bank, African manufacturing enterprises report an average of 56 days of power outages per year, causing firms to lose 5 to 6% of sales revenues, and for the informal underground economy, such losses could be up to 20% of revenues each year. In Bangladesh, a World Bank study recently found that having access to electricity has a cumulative impact on increasing rural household incomes by as much as 20%, resulting in a corresponding drop in the poverty rate of about 15%. Another World Bank study quotes surveys in Bangladesh as finding that study time for school children is up to 33% higher for those whose homes have electricity. To put it another way, every problem of the developing world is also an energy problem. The problem of education is about a teacher shortage and an energy shortage. The problem of healthcare in sub-Saharan Africa is about a shortage of doctors and medicines, and a shortage of energy to run medical equipment and refrigerate drugs. Unemployment in rural India is about a skills shortage, an investment shortage, and a shortage of the energy needed to keep factories running. Agricultural weakness in Bangladesh is about shortages of seeds, fertilizer, and land, and a shortage of energy to pump water or power equipment. Energy poverty, concluded Freeling, creeps into every single aspect of existence and wipes out any hope of climbing out of economic poverty into the 21st century. To be sure, the rural and urban poor have long survived with limited energy, wood and dung to burn, animals to pull plows, water to carry boats. And for 100 years or so after electricity became widespread in the industrialized world, they carried on using their traditional forms of energy, augmenting it when possible with petrol or some battery-powered devices or a jerry-rigged line to an electricity pole. But being energy poor is not what it used to be, not in a world that is hot, flat, and crowded. It is so much more punishing and destabilizing. When the world is hot and you don't have access to electricity, your ability to adapt to climate change is dangerously limited. When the world is flat and you don't have access to electricity, you have no ability to use computers, cell phones, or the internet, all the tools that are now central to global commerce, education, collaboration, and innovation. When the world is crowded and you don't have access to electricity, your ability to thrive in your village is limited, and you are much more likely to have to move to an already overcrowded slum in a megacity like Mumbai, Shanghai, or Lagos. Today, more than ever, economic growth comes with an on-off switch. Energy today unlocks so much more knowledge, unleashes so much more potential, provides so much more protection, and, as a result, creates so much more stability than it used to. Therefore, energy poverty not only holds back the world's most vulnerable people, it deprives the rest of us of their potential contributions. Let's look closer to see why. Energy poverty and the hot world. In a world that is hot, a world that is more and more affected by global warming, guess who is going to suffer the most? it will be the people who caused it the least, the poorest people in the world, who have no electricity, no cars, no power plants, and virtually no factories to emit CO2 into the atmosphere. Many of the 2.4 billion people who live on $2 a day or less reside in rural areas and depend directly on soil, forests, and plants in their immediate vicinity for subsistence. Climate change experts broadly agree that increases in global average temperature, wind, evaporation rates, and precipitation are going to increasingly produce more meteorological extremes. Heavier and more violent rains in some regions and more intense and prolonged droughts in others. All this will be a nightmare for the energy poor in the countryside. Heavier and more intense rains mean that less water soaks into the ground and more runs off to the sea, so soils can become thinner and more vulnerable to higher evaporation rates between rainfalls. This drying out of the land also increases the possibility of wildfires. Without electricity, adaptation to these extremes is only going to be that much more difficult. Many areas populated by the rural poor already have overstressed water supplies due to overexploitation, deforestation, population explosions, and poor water quality maintenance. If climate change increases droughts in these areas, as it already started to do in parts of Africa and southern Europe, the energy poor will not be able to resort to running a fan longer, refrigerating more food or medicine, or desalinating water as people with electricity could do. And the deeper the water tables sink, the more the poor will need electricity or fuel to pump water up from deeper wells. Those of the world's poor living in low-lying coastal communities, like Bangladesh, will also be forced to migrate inland by any significant rise in sea levels. Meanwhile, those living at higher elevations will be more exposed to insect-borne diseases because the higher elevations of Africa and Latin America are warming faster than the lowlands, so mosquitoes can now carry malaria to higher slopes. If temperatures continue to rise, this will expose millions more people in both continents, and the energy poor cannot escape by closing the windows and turning on an air conditioner. Take just one country, Rwanda. In most of the countryside, there is no grid, and generators that run on gasoline or diesel are becoming more expensive by the day to operate. How are the Rwandans going to maintain vaccines, provide clean water, run fans, or operate a clinic to improve health care over the long run, or simply adapt to climate change without reliable energy, clean or dirty, cheap or expensive? While the energy poor wait to get connected, they need all the help we can extend for protecting and restoring the forests, coral reefs, and other natural habitats in and around which they live, because these natural systems can help buffer poor people against climate disruptions before they get connected to the grid. For example, coastal mangrove forests protect low-lying communities against floods and rising sea levels. In the 2004 Asian tsunami, communities that had protected their coral reefs and mangrove forests suffered less damage than those who had converted them to beachfront hotels and shrimp farms. Also, upland forests help to provide more reliable water supplies as droughts become more prevalent and glaciers recede, leaving less water available. There is even a connection to malaria. Recent research has shown that areas that have been deforested are more prone to malaria because the muddy pools left behind by loggers provide more breeding habitats for mosquitoes. Adaptation to climate change is not just about electrons and seawalls. It's about conservation. Even some of those with a connection to the grid are seeing their power diminished because of climate change. In June 2006, I visited Peru, where, in the sacred valley of the Incas, I met José Ignacio Lambari, who owned a 60-acre farm. He did not describe what was happening to him as global weirding, but he certainly described the symptoms. Lambari told me that for most of his life, he had been growing giant white corn with kernels that used to be as big as quarters. This giant corn, which was exported to Spain and Japan, grew in his valley because of a unique combination of water, temperature, soil, and sun. But recently, Lambari said, he started to notice something. The water level is going down, and the temperature is going up. As a result, the giant corn kernels weren't growing quite as large as they used to. New pests had started appearing, and there was no longer enough water to plant the valley terraces that date from Incan times. He also noticed that the snow line he had grown up looking at for 44 years was starting to recede. "I tell my wife," he said to me, "the day that mountain loses its snow, we will have to move out of the valley." Like Lambari, farmers all over the world have come to depend on glaciers to feed their rivers and drive their hydroelectric dams. But with temperatures rising and winters shortened, the glaciers are not providing the snowmelt they once did. This is already sparking conflict. Lambari told me that every year he and his fellow farmers decide by committee how to divide up the water. Now, every year the meetings get more heated because there is less water to distribute and the same amount of land that needs it, he said. When I shared this story with the physicist and climate specialist Joseph Rahm, he recalled that the word rival actually comes from people who share the same river. Look it up. I did. The Random House Webster's Unabridged Dictionary says, one who uses a stream in common with another. If global warming plays out anywhere near the projections, the world is going to have a lot more rivals. Energy poverty and the flat world. 50 years ago, if you were a poor person living in the developing world and didn't have electricity, you were certainly at a disadvantage. But though the gap between you and someone in the developed world was large, it was not unbridgeable. You could still write a letter with pen and paper, you could still walk to the local post office to drop off that letter, and you could still find a library in your capital and read a book printed on paper, even if you had to walk 50 miles to get there. 50 years ago, poor or middle-class people in America might also have to walk to the library or post office or hop on a bicycle, but it was just a mile or two away. Still, once they arrived, they too found books and letters printed on paper. In other words, there was a gap. It was big, but it was not unbridgeable. Fast forward to today. If you don't have access to electricity, you don't have access to all the world's libraries, all the world's post office boxes, and almost all the world's stores and manufacturers. Because without electricity, you don't have access to a computer, a browser, the internet, the World Wide Web, Google, Hotmail, or any form of email or e-commerce. Therefore, you can't search those libraries online, you can't shop for the lowest prices, you can't send or receive an email from anyone to anywhere, and you can't write a letter or a book or a business plan on a screen that allows you to cut and paste with the click of a mouse. That means that you can't use any of the basic tools that people in the flat world are using to compete, connect, and collaborate. That's why, in a flat world, the gap between those who have electricity and those who don't grows exponentially, not arithmetically. Experts have probably known this for a long time. I discovered it quite by accident on a tour to a remote collection of villages in India in October 2007. I had traveled to the central Indian city of Hyderabad to visit B. Ramlinga Raju, the founder and chairman of Satyam, one of India's premier technology firms, and also co-founder of one of his country's biggest charitable foundations, Bairaju, which is working to alleviate rural poverty in India. Raju and his brother, Rama, arranged for me to visit a cluster of Indian villages in northeast Andhra Pradesh, about 350 miles from Hyderabad. Those villages were a tiny peephole, but they introduced me to the whole universe of energy poverty. In Podagatlapalli, I was greeted with a traditional shower of yellow flower petals and had a red dot smudged on my forehead. After a quick lunch, I was taken to see one of the village's crown jewels, a new health clinic funded by Bairaju. As I entered a small room, I was startled to find a very elderly man with dark brown skin and shocks of white hair covering his chest and arms, stripped down to his underwear and laid out on a table where he was connected to an electrocardiogram machine. Standing between him and a television set was a nurse technician in a white uniform who was operating the EKG monitor. On the television screen was a heart specialist sitting in a hospital in Bangalore, some 500 miles to the south. He was observing the EKG via satellite hookup and preparing to read the results and dispense a diagnosis. How wonderful, I thought to myself. This kind of telemedicine is the information technology revolution at its best. The world really is flat. But then I looked over into the right-hand corner of the room, and what I saw certainly sobered me up. The whole process, the EKG and the TV, was being powered by 16 car batteries connected to the electronic gear by a spaghetti-like tangle of wires. Why? Because in India, many, many villages, where 70% of the population resides, are not connected to an electricity grid. This was the energy technology revolution at its worst. When I wrote The World is Flat, I included a chapter called The Unflat World. I was aware that the technological forces that were leveling the global economic playing field had not completed their work. Many people still were unable to plug into the flat world platform. It was equally clear to me that every day this was becoming less true, that more and more people who made just $2 a day were able to buy cell phones with internet capability or get access to $100 laptops. In India today, roughly 7 million new cell phone subscribers are signed up each month, bringing the total by early 2008 to 200 million subscribers in a country of 1.1 billion people. And tomorrow, the cost of these tools of connectivity will fall further. Hence, my view that the flattening of the world is continuing apace. That is still true, but I have since come to appreciate that no matter how cheap these tools of connectivity become, the people at the bottom of the pyramid will only truly be connected when the world is both flat and green, when they have universal connectivity powered by abundant, clean, reliable, and cheap electrons. Why flat and green? Because it is critical that the developing world leapfrog the developed world in energy the same way it did with telephony. Many developing countries went from no phones to cell phones and never stopped for landlines and telephone poles. We have to hope that many of the 1.6 billion people without electricity will go from no electric grid to clean distributed energy like solar or wind without stopping for centrally generated coal-fired power. Yes, a certain amount of centrally generated coal-fired power is necessary for Africa or South Asia in the immediate future. Green alternatives are not yet scalable. But if all 1.6 billion people without electricity today were to connect to a power grid based on coal or natural gas or oil, the climate and pollution implications could be devastating. When you think how much climate change we have already triggered with just 3/4 of the world using fossil fuel-based electricity, imagine if we added another 1/4. This is why we desperately need abundant, clean, reliable, cheap electrons fast. The more we can bring down the price of solar, wind, or even nuclear energy and safely get these technologies into the hands of the world's poor, the more we can alleviate one problem, energy poverty, and prevent another, climate change and air pollution. During a winter break from college in January 2008, my daughter Natalie worked for several weeks as an intern in a community center in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe, for children who had lost parents to HIV/AIDS or were themselves afflicted. She could barely communicate with us while she was there, though, because repeated power outages had rendered the computers at her daycare center and many phones useless. Zimbabwe depends on South Africa for some of its electricity, and the grid there is under constant stress. The power outages have called into question the government's ability to meet its target of 6% annual growth, CNN.com reported from South Africa, January 29, 2008. They also have imperiled efforts to combat a 25% unemployment rate. That is hardly surprising. A computer that can't be booted up or a cell phone that can't be recharged is nothing more than a paperweight, less useful than a pen, paper, or a carrier pigeon. Just as you miss more when you don't have reliable electricity in a flat world, you also gain much more when you do have it, and so, potentially, does the whole global system. I caught a glimpse of that, too, through another peephole, also in the village of Podagatlapali, at a small elementary school supported by Bairaju. The school was a bare-bones cement structure, but the classroom I visited was packed with Indian kids who were taking turns working on 4 colorful, kid-proof learning stations manufactured by Little Tykes and IBM that come loaded with interactive educational software. Each of these kid-smart early learning program terminals was made of blue plastic and had a computer touchscreen in the middle. They are specifically designed to promote learning in remote areas, where qualified reading and writing teachers are always in short supply. But what I remember most is the image of 2 Indian kids, a boy in little blue shorts and a tiny girl in a white dress, who were sitting scrunched together on a single square stool at a KidSmart terminal, interacting with the touchscreen and listening to instructions through headphones. The headphones were adult size, and they dwarfed the heads of these 2 little kids like giant helmets. But sitting there, intensely operating that KidSmart terminal, those 2 kids looked so curious, so hungry to learn. I thought about them the whole way home, and the thought that kept coming back to me was that one of these kids could very well be the next Thomas Edison or Marie Curie, one of them the next Sally Ride or APJ Abdul Kalam, India's former president and premier rocket scientist. But that won't happen unless they get reliable access to energy technology to go with their now reliable access to information technology. The implications of bringing computers into rural classrooms and wirelessly linking those classrooms to the rest of the world are profound, said Robert Freeling. Students and teachers become excited as new programs in distance learning are introduced. Electronic friendships are established with people from faraway lands. Music and dance are shared. Cultural diversity is strengthened, even as the world becomes smaller. Wireless connectivity that doesn't need landlines and telephone poles, and distributed energy that doesn't need electricity lines and electricity poles, would do more to cure rural poverty in the developing world than any other innovations. In 2000, the Solar Electric Light Fund spearheaded an initiative to create the first solar-powered high school in South Africa, 2 hours from Durban in the Valley of 1,000 Hills. Myeka High School was equipped with a solar electric system that powered a computer lab as well as an internet-connected satellite dish. Later, SELF encouraged the students to participate in an essay contest sponsored by the International Solar Energy Society about the impact of solar power. The winner was 11th grader Samantha Dlomo, who wrote, "I am 16 years old and have lived in the rural area for the past 14 years. In all these past years, I used a candlestick to study and do my homework. The chalkboard has been the mainstay teaching aid at school. When a few solar panels were installed at school, I did not have even a faintest notion of how it was going to work. A few months later, we received an overhead projector. That was the beginning of a new school experience. The following equipment was later received: 20 computers, 2 television sets, and a video machine. Recently, we have been connected to the Learning Channel campus and the internet through the satellite. Learning is now going to be research-orientated. That is, we shall use worksheets and we shall use the internet as the main source of information. In the past, we spent much of our time copying notes from the chalkboard. The school has set itself a new vision for the new millennium. By the year 2005, it wants to produce learners who will follow careers in the fields of science, technology, engineering, medicine, and others. This was a far-fetched dream a few years ago. Imagine, if we could tap into the creativity and innovative capacity of the world's poorest people. Imagine if we could empower them with the tools and the energy they need to really compete, connect, and collaborate. It would lead to an explosion of innovation, from science and technology to art and literature, the likes of which the world has never seen. Abundant, clean, reliable, cheap power would create the world's first truly level playing field, notes Kurt Carlson, CEO of SRI International, a scientific research think tank in Silicon Valley. In doing so, it would unlock the innovative power of the very people who will help us solve the last remaining big problems we have around health, education, and energy. These solutions need to come from both the bottom up and the top down. Jeff Wacker, the futurist at Electronic Data Systems, likes to say that innovators are those people who know the 99% that everybody knows and therefore are able to create the 1% that nobody knows. If you don't know the 99% or cannot get access to it, you will not have the foundation to create the new 1%. More likely, you will just recreate part of the 99% that everyone already knows. If we can make the unflat world flatter by extending electricity to the 1.6 billion people who don't have it, we can connect all those brains to the 99% that everybody knows and have so many more people working on the 1% that nobody knows. That is when you will have innovation everywhere, says Wacker. The Economist has dubbed it the age of mass innovation. As their writer Vijay Vaitheeswaran put it, October 11, 2007, the history of innovation is filled with elites and centralized processes. But look closer and you find that ordinary people have always silently played a role. In his A Culture of Improvement, Technology, and the Western Millennium, Robert Friedel shows how countless small efforts by individuals from all rungs on society's ladder contributed to the astonishing advances that we enjoy in today's postmodern, post-industrial societies. Imagine how much better firms and countries could innovate if they could harness the distributed creative potential of all these innovators in waiting. In an age of mass innovation, the world may even find profitable ways to deliver solutions to the 21st century's greatest needs, including sustainable clean energy, affordable and universal health care for aging populations, and quite possibly entirely new industries. The one natural resource that the world has left in infinite quantity is human ingenuity. Energy poverty and the crowded world. Energy can not only make a hotter world more tolerable and a flatter world more equitable, it can also make a crowded world more comfortable. I saw that through one more illuminating peephole in Andhra Pradesh. It was in the village of Ithakota. There, Satyam, whose main business is running the back office and outsourced operations for large global companies, had set up a remote data center. Beginning in 2006, Satyam dispatched some of the simpler outsourcing work that the company had been doing from its Hyderabad headquarters to be performed by villagers in Ithakota. Amid the banana and palm groves, 120 college-educated Indian villagers, trained by Satyam and connected to the world by wireless networks, were processing data for a British magazine publisher and selling services for an Indian phone company. The data center operates in 2 8-hour shifts, but it could run 3 if only the electricity didn't go off for 6 hours a day. As I interviewed workers at the Ithakota data center, I discovered something I did not expect. Several of them were city slickers. They had been born in the area, had migrated to India's megacities for work, and then had chosen to come back to Ithakota to live because, although the pay was lower, the life was richer and more tranquil. Thanks to the Satyam facilities, they could live locally and act globally, as long as they had the electricity to do so. Suresh Varma, age 30, one of the data managers, was working for a U.S. oil company in Hyderabad, but decided to move back to this lush village where his parents came from. It was like moving from a Silicon Valley to a real valley, he explained. I have a much higher quality of life here than in the urban area anywhere in India. The city is concrete. You spend most of your time in traffic just getting from one place to another. Here, you walk to work. Here, I am in touch with what is happening in the cities, but at the same time, I don't miss out on my professional aspirations. Unlike in the city, where there is now a high turnover rate at outsourcing centers that operate overnight, in the village, nobody gives up these jobs, said Verghese Jacob, who heads Bairaju, which plans to gradually hand over ownership of the data processing centers to the villagers. They are very innovative and positive, and because some of them had never worked on a computer before, their respect for the opportunity is so much more than for a city child who takes it for granted. This phenomenon, if it could be implemented on a large scale, could provide relief for India's strained megacities like Mumbai, 19 million people, and Calcutta, 15 million, which simply cannot keep growing. The social and environmental implications of packing more and more people into such relatively small areas are already becoming unbearable for those on the bottom rung. The only solution is to strengthen villages. Jacob estimates that just one of his rural outsourcing centers creates the same amount of employment and income as 400 acres of rural Indian farmland. India, in other words, could, in effect, mint more farmland in its countryside by creating these knowledge service centers with a couple hundred jobs each. This could make its villages much more viable places than cities for young people to build their futures. But they need both abundant, clean, reliable, and cheap electrons and connectivity, internet, and telephones. With connectivity, villagers can get up-to-date knowledge of farming techniques and market prices that will help them to obtain higher value for their produce. Internet access enables village artisans to upload digital pictures of locally made arts and crafts and to make their goods directly available to a world market. People in India and China leave their villages and cram themselves and their families into megacities, not because they actually like living that way, but in many cases, simply because that is where the jobs and opportunities are. That is always going to be true to some extent, but we can make it less true if we can bring to villages what Satyam did, an ecosystem of energy plus education plus connectivity plus investment. That is what makes a sustainable village. And we need to make a lot of sustainable villages. Every time you make a village work, you not only help the poor, most of whom still live in villages, but you also create a better balance in the world. To make villages work, though, you have to empower people to live locally and act globally. You have to give them opportunity and access. But to empower takes power, electric power. For the first time in the history of the world, we have the opportunity to achieve a balance between localization and globalization at scale, says K.R. Sridhar, the Indian-born co-founder and CEO of Bloom Energy. If the rural poor on every continent no longer feel they have to move to cities and take manufacturing jobs or drive taxis or work as maids because they have the tools and skills to connect globally and the abundant, clean energy to support their connectivity, they will be able to get the best out of both localization and globalization, said Sridhar. They will be able to remain in the countryside, enjoy its benefits, maintain their traditions, food, dress, and family ties, but also be able to generate the income they need to thrive. Also, the more that rural populations have their standards of living raised, the fewer children mothers will have, another way to reduce crowding. And when you can get localization and globalization into balance, what you end up with is humanization, an age of humanization, argues Sridhar. When you have roots, local, and wings, global, you can be both grounded and aspiring. You can realize your full human potential. But that can only happen if IT and ET, information technology and energy technology, flat and green, are working together, because only then can everyone and everything be both distributed and connected. If we can get that, said Sridhar, the world will have a new operating system. Chapter 8. Green is the new red, white, and blue. We have exactly enough time, starting now. The late Dana Meadows, Dartmouth College environmentalist. In 2006, I was invited by a student energy environment group at Stanford to give a talk on campus about green innovation. As I was pacing around backstage, the school's president, John Hennessy, went through the standard introduction, but then offered his own framing of the issues, saying that confronting today's energy climate challenge is the epitome of what John Gardner, the founder of Common Cause, once described as a series of great opportunities disguised as insoluble problems. I love that description. a series of great opportunities disguised as insoluble problems. In a few words, it captures perfectly how we should approach the future. In the first half of this program, I have tried to describe the seemingly insoluble problems that have emerged in the energy-climate era. Energy supply and demand imbalances, petro-dictatorship, climate change, energy poverty, and biodiversity loss that are going to shape our lives and our planet in the coming years. In the second half, I will try to show that solving these problems is, indeed, a great opportunity for any country that rises to the challenge. Why an opportunity? Quite simply, because the human race can no longer continue to power its growth with the fossil fuel-based system that has evolved since the Industrial Revolution and thrust us into the energy-climate era. If we do, the Earth's climate, forests, rivers, oceans, and ecosystems are going to be increasingly disrupted. We need a new clean energy system to drive our economies forward and bring more people out of poverty without despoiling our planet, and therefore the countries, communities, and companies that invent and deploy clean power technologies most effectively will have a dominant place in tomorrow's global economy. Because in a world that is hot, flat, and crowded, where energy, water, land, natural resources, and energy resources are all being stressed, everybody, in time, is going to be forced to pay the true cost of the energy they are using, the true cost of the climate change they are causing, the true cost of the biodiversity loss they are triggering, the true cost of the petro-dictatorship they are funding, and the true cost of the energy poverty they are sustaining. You will not be able to charge these costs on your children's credit cards any longer. Either Mother Nature, the global community, your own customers, your own neighbors, your own kids, or your own employees are going to demand that you, your company, or your country pay the total cost of ownership for whatever you or they produce or consume, argues Andrew Shapiro, CEO of Green Order, a strategy firm that helps companies profit from environmental innovation. That total cost of ownership will include the costs that are near-term and long-term, direct and indirect, seen and hidden, financial, social, geopolitical, and environmental. Why am I sure that we will have to pay in the future? Two reasons. The first is that we have already passed the tipping points regarding energy supply and demand, petro-dictatorship, climate change, energy poverty, and biodiversity loss. There are no cushions left. There's nowhere to hide. There are no more green fields to dump your garbage into, no more oceans to overfish, no more endless forests to cut down. We have reached a stage where the effects of our way of life on the Earth's climate and biodiversity can no longer be externalized or ignored or confined. Our environmental savings account is empty. It is not pay now or pay later. It is pay now or there will be no later. The second reason I am sure we will all have to pay is that the true costs of all these things are becoming visible, measurable, accessible, and inescapable. In a flat world, everyone can see what everyone else is doing and the harm it is causing. Therefore, in the coming years, there will be no avoiding accountability for the total cost of ownership of what you produce and consume. The days of a subprime planet are over. A planet we could own for no money down, where there were no interest payments until sometime far into the future and all the true costs were hidden, or chopped up into such little pieces and scattered in so many directions that no one knew who owned what. Put it all together, and what it means is that in the energy climate era, green is no longer a fad. Green is no longer a boutique statement. Green is no longer something you do to be good and hope that it pays off in 10 years. Green is the way you grow, build, design, manufacture, work, and live because it is just better, said Andrew Shapiro. Green becomes the smartest, most efficient, lowest-cost way, when all the true costs are included, to do things. That is the huge transition we are just beginning to see. Green is going from boutique to better, from a choice to a necessity, from a fad to a strategy to win, from an insoluble problem to a great opportunity. That's why I am convinced that the ability to develop clean power and energy-efficient technologies is going to become the defining measure of a country's economic standing, environmental health, energy security, and national security over the next 50 years. The ability to design, build, and export green technologies for producing clean electrons, clean water, clean air, and healthy and abundant food is going to be the currency of power in the energy climate era. Not the only one, but right up there with computers, microchips, information technologies, and planes and tanks. Some see that now. Others will see it soon. Eventually, it will be obvious to all. I hope every country gets there sooner rather than later, but as an American, I want to make sure that my country is in the lead. The green economy is poised to be the mother of all markets, the economic investment opportunity of a lifetime, because it has become so fundamental, observes Lois Quam, Managing Director of Alternative Investments at Piper Jaffray, an investment company. The challenge of global warming presents us all with the greatest opportunity for return on investment and growth that any of us will ever see. To find any equivalent economic transformation, you have to go back to the Industrial Revolution. And in the Industrial Revolution, there was a very clear before and after. After, everything was different. Industries had come and gone, civic society changed, new social institutions were born, and every aspect of work and daily life had been altered. With that came the emergence of new global powers. This clean technology transformation will be an equivalent moment in history. Already, Quam noted, there are about 8 million green jobs in the United States, if you count those retooling existing industries and those working in the new renewable industries. And that's just the beginning. For all these reasons, this is not your grandfather's green movement anymore. This is Code Green. It's about national power. Everything America or any country can do to go green today will make it stronger, healthier, more secure, more innovative, more competitive, and more respected. What could be more patriotic, capitalistic, and geostrategic than that? That's why I say that green is the new red, white, and blue. Because it is a strategy that can help to ease global warming, biodiversity loss, energy poverty, petro-dictatorship, and energy supply shortages, and make America stronger at the same time. We solve our own problems by helping the world solve its problems. We help the world solve its problems by solving our own problems. Depending on which audience you are speaking with, you can stress one or the other, but these truths are mutually reinforcing. To environmentalists, I say, let's make America the greenest country in the world, the leader in mitigating climate change, innovating clean power, and protecting biodiversity, and the